Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Yesterday, July 14th, was the 232nd anniversary of Bastille Day, which is France's Independence Day, and is generally regarded as the beginning of the French Revolution in 1789. The hated symbol of kings and arbitrary rule, the French rebels were determined to attack and destroy the ancient prison. They were joined by the Garde Française, which had been sent to stop them. When the Bastille defenders refused to surrender, the mob stormed the prison and demolished it. Thomas Paine, author of Common Sense, which earlier inflamed the American Revolution the previous decade, wrote as inspiration for the French Revolution, The Rights of Man. That the Bastille was attacked with an enthusiasm of heroes, such as only the highest animation of liberty could inspire, Paine wrote. As it is not difficult to perceive from the enlightened state of humankind, that hereditary governments are verging to their decline, and that revolutions on the broad basis of national sovereignty and government are making their way in Europe, it would be an act of wisdom to anticipate their approach and produce revolutionary reason and accommodation rather than commit them to the issues of convulsions. From what we now see, nothing of reform in the political world ought to be held improbable. It is an age of revolutions in which everything may be looked for. And that was Thomas Paine. I start today's program with a short essay by Katrin Bridget Snow, Liberty and the Bastille, which first appeared in the North Coast Times Eagle. She is a former program director of KMUN and works for National Public Radio in San Francisco. She lived in France some years ago. Liberty and the Bastille by Katrin Bridget Snow. If you stand at night in the center of Paris's golden-lit bridge, Le Pont de la Concorde, and face roughly west, you will see to the right La Tour Eiffel, its graceful lines and small lights against the dark blue sky. To the left is the Cathedral de Notre Dame, sitting quietly at a bend in the slow river, looking small in the distance. It's not far from the cathedral to where you stand, perhaps a 30-minute walk, past the Palace of Justice, past the Louvre Museum, where one king used to hunt on horseback down the long halls, though the Garden of the Tuileries to the Place de la Concorde. The Place de la Concorde is a whirlpool of cars, four deep, swirling around a tall monument at the center, then streaming down the Seine or up the Champs-Élysées. The U.S. Embassy is just on the other side of the place, as are the fine leather glove and handbag shops. This is what you would see as an American visitor to the city. If, however, you were a Parisian factory worker in the summer of 1789, you might have tread these 30 minutes from the Hotel de Ville behind the Notre Dame to Les Invalides, between the Pont de la Concorde, and taken one of the 32,000 muskets stored there to defend yourself against the king's troops rumored to be surrounding Paris. And if you were a woman a few years later, you might have sat with Dickens, Madame Defarge, in the Place de la Concorde near the guillotine, and knitted as tumbril after tumbril rolled past, carrying aristocracy to be beheaded. Tradition has it that the French Revolution began with the storming of the Bastille in a peasant's revolt against aristocratic power on the 14th of July, 1789. But the crowd's original intent was not to free prisoners. It was to demand ammunition to protect the people of Faubourg Saint-Antoine, towards which the Bastille cannon was pointed. There had been minor riots for 3 days over the state of the parliamentary assembly at Versailles, and Parisians feared more violence from the aristocracy and military. The people of Faubourg Saint-Antoine feared cannon fire from the Bastille to the west, and an imminent attack from some 30,000 troops, rumored to be coming from the east. There were only 7 prisoners in the Bastille on July 14, 1789, none political prisoners. The fortress had long been used only for discreet imprisonment of the wealthy or influential. While it still represented despotism for the workers, few, if any, of the thousands amassing outside it that day were in a position to know who might be inside the fortress. The government had been unsteady for some time, but the balance of power tipped discernibly towards the assembly in mid-June when King Louis XVI ordered the parliamentary assembly, the Third Estate, to dissolve, and they refused. The king stopped just short of using military force. Instead, on July 11th, Louis sent the director of finance, Necker, into exile. Bankers and shopkeepers who had looked to Necker's fiscal policies to restore a sound economy protested and marched up the Champs-Élysées into skirmishes with the king's soldiers. Communications with the court at Versailles were cut off July 13th. Rumors flew that the king's troops were surrounding the city, strengthened with large groups of brigands, the outlaws who destroyed crops from village to town and survived through smuggling and violence. Parisians made the trek to the Bastille on the 14th for ammunition and self-defense. They did not know that the governor inside the fortress, Delaunay, had no provisions, no orders from Versailles, an ineffective cannon, and a garrison of mostly aged soldiers who did not want to open fire at the people. Negotiations between Delaunay and members of the bourgeoisie began amicably until each side, misinterpreting the other, thought it was under attack. Crowds pushed across the drawbridge. Most of the garrison escaped, and the rest were killed. Delaunay made it as far as the Hotel de Ville before his head was speared to parade around the city. It was the beginning of a violence that would escalate in 3 years to the Reign of Terror, the bloody extermination of the aristocracy, romanticized in A Tale of Two Cities and The Scarlet Pimpernel. It is controversial whether or not the economy played a large role in the revolution of 1789. The price of grain had been the source of unrest and riots in the provinces since early that year. Relaxed export laws had pulled much of the grain from storage, and the harvest of 1788 was poor. Bread prices doubled in Paris and quadrupled in the provinces. Vintners were especially hard hit, since the grape harvest had been abnormally good, driving down the price of wine. The aristocracy was suspected of a conspiracy to hoard grain and to keep the price up. The brigands, terrorizing the countryside, were suspected of being in the pay of the aristocracy. However, it was Necker's dismissal that provided the people of Paris with a concrete reason for massive protest. Necker had a name for reform and sound finance, and it had been disagreement over specific economic proposals which put the very existence of the assembly in question. Paris was on edge over the threats to the Third Estate and the rumored looming massacre by government troops and brigands. Necker's exile was the outrage which began the riots. In the provinces, word of the Paris riots spread and peasants attacked the chateau, destroying records of credit and debt. Their own revolt was not a direct protest of events at Versailles. They had distrusted Necker for supposed deals with grain millers, which benefited landowners. The peasants were starving, they were penniless, and they were afraid of the traveling brigands. As the struggle continued between the king and increasingly powerful National Assembly and the various interests of the bourgeoisie and the working class, the food shortage did not abate. By October, the aristocracy had all exiled to Versailles and the Parisians pushed for Louis's return to Paris as a solution to the unrest and economic crisis. He returned in early October to the Louvre, and the assembly followed, installing itself at the Tuileries on November 9th. In the ensuing struggle for power between the king and the assembly, the king gradually lost sovereign rule. Few people would have foreseen the coming terror when the guillotine would reign sovereign over the bloody Place de Concorde. The Tuileries are just east of the Place de la Concorde, with well-groomed trees planted in even squares and long straight paths which stretch to the Louvre. Walking north across the Point de la Concorde, you can turn and walk through the long gardens toward the lights of the Louvre beyond, or you could meander up the Champs-Élysées, admiring the fur coats and the pet poodles which parade up and down the boulevard. Either way you turn, you will walk toward the Place de la Concorde. History is alive in Paris. The passion is embedded in the streets. As you walk through the place, it takes only a little concentration to imagine the streets sticky with blood and yourself pressed into the crowd, standing before the guillotine. And that was Liberty and the Bastille by Catherine Bridget Snow, whom, as I said before, was a former program director of KMUN. And now something I wrote. The first and eternal freedom and the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. And that was the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, December 15, 1791. 2 years after the Bastille was stormed and ignited the French Revolution of 1789, something almost an afterthought tacked on to the American Constitution as its first 10 amendments were adopted into law as the most basic rights of the recently liberated common citizenry. The First Amendment, which is the crowning capstone and safeguard of the other nine, guarantees the freedom of a free press in the assumption that liberty survives only in an atmosphere of free and open expression of thought and opinion, no matter how diverse or uncomfortable. Controversy is, in fact, the language of democracy. Yet those who rule in democracy's name continually attempt to limit the range of ideas and information necessary to engage in the argument of opinion indispensable to political and personal freedom. The First Amendment is unequivocal. Congress, which makes law, shall make no law that abridges freedom of expression, whether vocal or written, nor, for that matter, deny the right of the people to peacefully assemble in dissent, nor interfere in religious belief or personal denial of religion, or allow any religion to proscribe any other religion. The First Amendment can be broken down into several categories, at least the following eight, compiled by Harriet F. Pilpel, who was a civil rights attorney and women's rights activist. First, the freedom to speak, the right to speak, the right to communicate freely and without restraint. Second, the right to listen, the freedom to read, to watch, and to hear. Third is the right to not speak or write, or refuse to communicate. Fourth is the right to not be forced to listen or see, part of another constitutional right to privacy. In this context, the right to not be subjected to sight, sound, or smell that one wishes to avoid but has no way of avoiding. Fifth is the right to anonymity, the right to communicate and receive communication anonymously. Sixth is the right to know, the right for government to not keep secrets from the common folk. Seventh is the right to access, which is, in a way, a part of the first category. It is not enough to have freedom to speak if all of the effective media of communication are unavailable, either as a result of government action or non-action on the part of private interests which control the media. The eighth category asks the question of whom, in all its various meanings, does the First Amendment apply? It applies to government itself in all its branches, federal to local, and to private groups which in effect exercise government power, such as company towns or shopping centers. And those are the eight freedoms as compiled by Harriet Tubman. The right to speak, think, and write openly of what one thinks. The freedom of association, belief, or religion. These are, as the Declaration of Independence says, inalienable rights. And the primary purpose of government in a democracy is to secure, protect, and enlarge those rights. The Bill of Rights were added to the main frame of the Constitution by clamorous popular demand as its heart and to give teeth to those inalienable rights, limiting not only government, but also majority obstinacy, as well as avaricious minority inquisitions from appropriating or usurping liberty and justice for all. Neither a majority or minority are allowed to seize or subtract the Bill of Rights, no matter how unpopular or incompatible they might seem in a particular moment or era, although voting rights are currently under siege by repellent right-wing racists who think America is whites only. The USA is not a nation seeking liberty, as our revolutionary ancestors once found necessary. Instead, the attempt is to preserve what remains of functional democracy against domestic cults of its own citizens who crave not only autocratic power, but elimination of various races, religions, and liberalistic orthodoxies that inhabit the USA. The pragmatic ancestors who wrote the Constitution knew very well that governments eventually swallow the rights of their citizens, and that the natural inclination of authority is to concentrate and perpetuate power by any means. Reflexively, government subverts all but its ruling classes, even if the system originated to provide rights to the governed. Constitutional law simply makes it more difficult for government pashas to rule so completely with an iron hand. The Bill of Rights especially acts as counterpoint. However, from the very beginning of American democracy, a powerful cabal of elites has insisted that the rights and privileges of constitutional law belong to the wealthy and propertied, and that its dues and obligations are the responsibility of everyone else. These Yankee Doodle despots would suspend the Bill of Rights and insist what they consider the original intent of the Constitution's authors, who were mainly white wealthy merchants and landowners, many of whom were slaveholders, should be its only interpretation. It is an absurd and dangerous notion, contrary to the actual intent of the Constitution's framers, to make it broad and flexible enough to reflect future problems and ideas they knew they were unable to anticipate or too contemporarily divided in opinion to immediately resolve, among them the large movements to emancipate slaves and women. The Bill of Rights and subsequent amendments clarify that the original intent of the Constitution was not quite so rigid or restrictive as so-called strict Reconstructionists, quote-unquote, claim, but instead is literally an amendable document capable at least of attempting to reflect a continually fluctuating civilization. And it is obvious that fresh amendments to the Constitution are necessary, such as a more specific Bill of Rights advocated by Stacey Abrams for racial and political equality, a popularly elected president, a more representative Senate with reduced powers, election of House of Representatives every 4 years, 16-year terms for Supreme Court justices, perhaps even a new legislative chamber for issues affecting Native Americans, among a plethora of other constitutional readjustments. The USA is an amendable democracy, capable of mending its ways without insurrection or civil war, with so far one notable exception, which was race-based, somewhat similar with the current turmoil embroiling the nation. The struggle for equity and justice is never ending, often losing more than gained. The incessant struggle, paradoxical because everything will be lost without resistance to contravailing inquisitions. The laws of the Constitution, and especially the Bill of Rights, simply make it more difficult for repressive government to expropriate near total power. It is a direct responsibility of a democratic people to contain the power of repressive government and anti-democracy insurgencies, such as threatens the USA currently. The political freedom and power of the common citizenry has been made the law of this roiling democracy to protect it from predatory seizure of government through bad law appropriating such usurpation. Laws that cripple voting, such as are now prevalent, that make Swiss cheese of democracy. Yet a government of the people is assumed to be a government for the people, so it is entrusted to act in the people's behalf, to prevent or correct excesses of monopolistic and unprincipled private interests, which is in contrast to this era of virulent capitalism abetted by government despite the current wave of reform. Dismantling of government protections alters government's role from acting as benefactor and guardian of civil rights and liberties to its more ominous nature of enforcer of a reigning status quo, which is rancorously articulated by the wealthy corporate elite and religious right. The problem is that few Americans truly understand the responsibilities of a democracy. Independence and equal rights do not come easily and never stay very long without constant nourishing and nurturing. It took a long time for the people to be convinced of the possibilities of independence, even though our predecessors inherited a powerful but thwarted tradition of primitive justice. America's revolution was in fact the result of bitter disappointment. The mother country did not recognize the loyalty to ancient principles the English colonies in North America felt they had exhibited in resisting what they considered illegal and proscriptive edicts intolerable to honest and loyal subjects. Political and personal rights and liberties hard won by one generation are unfortunately eroded by successors who are generally careless with them without realizing how rare, necessary, and fragile they are. The farther removed from the intense imperatives of ancestors for freedom and equality, the more they are taken for granted, and the greater the danger they will be heedlessly frittered away. The endless looping cycles of individual and collective rights and obligations to protect and continue democratic life are distinctly at play in this viciously unsettled period of trauma, duplicity, and insurrectionary threat. It is necessary to confront and attempt to comprehend at their core the most cherished vanities, theories, philosophies, and moral roots of our democratic civilization at their most vulnerable levels. In particular, the faltering myth that the unfettered will of the citizenry is inherently able to preserve democracy. The necessary research to patiently trace the confused, often corrupt tentacles to their origins, and from that prime point, realize how democracy got off track of its history our ancestors intended to navigate when they declared they could no longer abide the oppression and tyranny of a king. What is democracy? The right to not be recognized by gender, race, or class, but by the simple fact of a person's existence on earth. The right to be counted on and respected for personal and independent expression of belief and opinion. The right to be the only person on earth who believes in something no one else does. Viva democracy. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk is engineer of this program. Tomorrow, July 16, 1945, is the day of Trinity, when the USA tested the first nuclear explosion at Los Alamos, New Mexico. And on July 20th, 1969, the first humans walked on the moon. More down to earth, step lightly into the greater world that is not yet disinfected from the plague that has burrowed much of humanity this past year and more. Enjoy your summer with necessary caution for yourself and everybody else. Earthwalk intelligently.